Quantum Feedback Loop podcast. I'm your host, James Myers, and I also publish The Quantum Record, which features the latest in science and technology. It was a pleasure meeting with Louis Rosenberg to learn about a technology called Swarm AI and its potential to facilitate a collective superintelligence among humans. It's a different technological paradigm, one in which the machine doesn't make decisions, but instead connects groups of people to amplify their collective decision-making ability. It's intriguing to consider the possibilities from the case studies that Louis describes, built on nature's example of swarm intelligence among fish, bees, and other species. We talked about human control over the technology and the transparency of its operation, points that are especially important now when many powerful technologies like large language models operate as black boxes in ways the user doesn't know. Louis has a decades-long background in virtual reality, and towards the end of our discussion, he speaks about the growing power of VR technologies, his role with the Responsible Metaverse Alliance, and his new book, Our Next Reality. As Louis describes the ways that virtual reality technologies are seeking to alter what we see, hear, and experience in our everyday lives, I was struck by the urgency for action to ensure that we humans remain in control of our own reality. Is collective superintelligence the answer for a future of humans, made by humans, and for humans? I don't know. But what I do know is that the options for the future that Louis presents at the conclusion of our talk demand immediate attention and a very broad discussion to ensure, as Louis says, that humans remain in the loop. So now, please join me in discussion with Louis Rosenberg as he explores collective human superintelligence and the crucial choices that lie ahead for us in time. Well, welcome, Louis, and thank you for joining us on the Quantum Feedback Loop. I'm looking forward to learning about the idea of collective superintelligence and to talk about a new book that I understand that you're publishing this month.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. Happy to talk all about it.
Wondering if you could share some of your history in AI and virtual reality and the motivation that led you to create your latest venture, Unanimous AI.
Yeah. So I've spent my whole career really in focusing on three technologies, virtual reality, augmented reality, and artificial intelligence. And they might seem a little disparate, but really my background and my interest is in human-computer interaction and using technology to amplify the abilities of people. And so back in the early 90s, I was a graduate student working in this field. And so I started focusing on virtual reality because it was at that point, it only had emerged a few years earlier. And there was great potential for potentially enhancing human abilities. And I was lucky enough to become do research at NASA and Stanford in virtual reality, looking at the early issues of how you create these virtual environments. And I was pretty much convinced even then, 30 years ago, that one day immersive media, immersive technologies would make a really big difference in how we humans interact with information. And I still believe that. I actually thought it would happen much faster than it did. And so I didn't think it would take 30 years to get there. But I do think we are right about there, where immersive media will really become an important part of computing. From the work I did at Stanford and NASA, the one thing I really didn't like about the immersive technologies of virtual reality was that it cuts you off from the real world. And what I found in doing experiments with lots of people was that they could see that this was amazing, but I also could tell that they were happy when the demo was over because it's not natural for you to be cut off from the world. And so what I really wanted to do was to enable these immersive experiences just in your natural surroundings so you can be with other people, be in your office. And that took me to Air Force Research Laboratory, where I worked on really what was the first mixed reality system, a system called the Virtual Fixtures Platform, where people could reach out and interact with real and virtual objects at the same time. And my focus there was to use that to enhance people's performance in manual tasks. So you can see virtual objects that would, and not just see, but see and feel virtual objects that could help you perform tasks, with the idea that one day surgeons would be able to perform a surgery on a real patient and have, the reason it was called virtual fixtures, they'd have these virtual fixtures over the patient that would help guide what they're going to do and even guide their motion. And again, that was we took a long time for the industry to get to there. But truth is, at last year was the first time people started really doing surgeries with FDA approval with mixed reality, helping them and guiding them. And so, so I then founded a virtual reality company in 93 called Immersion, which I ran for a decade, and we took public, and it's still around. But then I left in the 2000s and founded an augmented reality company that I also ran for a while, and we sold to Google. And then I was still really interested in this, how technology can help help human performance. And I started to realize that while it's really interesting to look at how technology can help individuals, it becomes even more interesting when you start thinking about groups and how can technology help groups, and how can artificial intelligence help make groups smarter. And then 10 years ago, I founded my current company, Unanimous AI, which is really a really different type of AI company. It's focused entirely on how you use AI, not to replace people, but to connect groups of people together to allow us to make better decisions and better forecasts and better predictions, significantly better than we could do alone or that we could do using traditional methods of collective intelligence. And so really my pursuit for the last 10 years has been this idea of collective superintelligence, how we can use the power of AI to combine the knowledge and wisdom and insights of groups in real time so we can make better decisions and become smarter together.
Interesting. And I understand it's sort of based on the idea of swarm intelligence that exists in the animal world, where groups of animals collectively accomplish things that they couldn't individually do.
Yeah. So it's the interesting thing is like a lot of researchers in a lot of different fields, I looked to Mother Nature to say, well, how does nature do this? And it's worth saying that the field of collective intelligence was really over 100 years old. It goes back to like 1906. Sir Francis Galton had done a famous experiment in the UK where he went to a county fair and asked basically farmers to estimate the weight of an ox. And he asked like 800 people to do that. And their forecasts were widely variant. But when he took the statistical mean, it was very accurate. And now we call it like the wisdom of crowds or collective intelligence. And it works. You can amplify the intelligence of groups by basically collecting information from them in isolation, aggregating it in a spreadsheet, or in his case, by hand, aggregating it, and get a better result. And so a decade ago, when I really started focusing in this area, I was surprised that the way we were doing collective intelligence hadn't changed for 100 years. Like we were still basically just collecting information in isolation and aggregating it and seeing a small amplification of intelligence. And so that was the inspiration for me to say, well, how does Mother Nature do it? And that's really what is always a good thing to do. And it turns out that many species have evolved over hundreds of millions of years that have addressed this issue where they've reached the intellectual capacity of their brains, usually because they're very small creatures and their brains are very small, and usually because they can't evolve to get larger, maybe because they fly and they can't get any bigger. And so swarm intelligence is what biologists use to refer to nature's methods of enabling large groups to make good decisions without any individual being in charge, but by combining the perspectives and input and the differences in viewpoint that all these creatures have. And so it's ultimately the reason why birds flock and fish school and bees swarm. They're smarter together than they would be on their own. And nature doesn't do it the way humans do it, by taking a vote or a poll or a survey. Nature does it by forming real-time systems with feedback loops that allow the groups to push and pull on each other and converge on a decision. And it's a good decision. So one species that's interesting to think about is a school of fish, which is why there's an image of a school of fish behind me. And a school of fish, there could be hundreds or even thousands of individuals. They each have a different view of the world. Some can see one in one direction, some can see in the other. Some are in the middle of the school, they can't even see outside. They all have different slightly different life history, life experiences, slightly different temperament. They're all different. Nobody is in charge. And yet this school of fish can function and make decisions together so cohesively. Biologists call them a superorganism because they can navigate the ocean and make all of the decisions of an entity as a collective. And they become smarter. They make smarter decisions. And the way fish do it is pretty amazing. They do it because they have a special organ on the sides of their body called a lateral line that detects vibrations in the water around them. So what happens is a fish is swimming along and they're basically communicating with all their neighbors because they can detect, how other fish are changing their speed and direction. And so if a fish on the left side sees a predator, and they react, that small group of fish can basically pass that information along. And because of all these little groups of neighbors overlap, the information propagates through the full population. Now, if there are fish on the other side of the school that also see a predator, they're also having information propagate through the whole. And so you have this whole system where the information propagates through and it basically becomes this multi-directional tug of war, pushing and pulling, and they'll make the best possible decision. They will escape from that predator, even though they all have different views of the world. And so at Unanimous AI, we said, well, if birds and bees and fish can get smarter by forming these real-time systems where the groups can push and pull in real time and converge on decisions that are smarter than any individuals can make, maybe humans can do it. And it turns out that we can. And that's really what we've been working on for the last 10 years. And the technology has advanced and is now getting to be the most interesting it's ever been. So that's kind of the history of why swarm intelligence is a really good guidepost to how to build a human collective superintelligence.
Well, and nature always provides the best examples, I think, for anything that we wind up doing. Yeah, really interesting. And can you just give us an example of how the application works, like, in a practical setting and one specific use for it?
Yeah. So there's really kind of two different generations of the technology, and it's worth talking through each because it helps appreciate how this field is evolving. When we first started working on this 10 years ago, we really looked to how the dynamics of fish schools and the dynamics actually of honeybees, both of which can make really, really good decisions. And it turns out honeybees have been shown to be even more interesting than fish schools because they've really complicated decisions to make. A colony of honeybees could have 10,000 bees. And one of the famous decisions that have been studied is every year or every few years, they will outgrow their hive, their nest, which is usually like a hole in the ground or a hole in a log. And they need to find a new one. And so what they do is they'll send out hundreds of scout bees. They'll go out and search the world for candidate sites. And these hundreds of scout bees will go find different locations. And then they'll come back to the colony. And now they have dozens of different options. And it turns out like that's amazing in itself that they could do this. But that's actually the easy part. The hard part is now they need to pick the best solution. So now they have like a dozen different options. They need to pick the best solution. How do they possibly do that? And they do it by forming this real-time system that works by vibrating their bodies. And so these fish vibrate their bodies. Sorry, these bees vibrate their bodies to represent the direction of the site that they found and the strength of their conviction for that site. And then other bees will vibrate their bodies in support of other locations that they support, that they've gone and looked at. And so now you have this tug of war where different, basically some bees are pulling for one option by the signal, the direction and magnitude of their vibration. Other bees are pulling for another option on the direction and magnitude of their vibration. There could be multiple different vibrations happening. And over time, they basically push and pull and eventually converge on one answer. And it's almost always the best answer. And researchers have shown that you could have this complex multivariable problem of all these different constraints, because a particular site that like they're trying to decide, like, is it have enough space to store the honey they need for the winter? And is it well ventilated? And is it near good sources of pollen? This multivariable problem, and yet the bees solve it through these vibrations, and they get the best answer like 80% of the time. And when they don't, they usually get the next best answer. And like, these are problems that would be hard for a human brain to solve, because they're complicated decisions. And so I give that history because when we built our first generation of technology, we said, well, let's replicate what bees do, which means bees can create signals with a magnitude and a direction and create bee in this tug of war. And so this first system we created, which we still use and works really well, is some people say it looks kind of like a Ouija board, because there's like a question pops up and it could have, you know, six different answers. And those could be, like in the case of bees, those could be six different home sites. Right? And each person can control a little magnet on their screen with a touch screen or their mouse or really any kind of input device. And the magnet, they can pull on this little glass puck with a magnet, with a direction and a magnitude. The closer the magnet gets to the puck, the stronger the pull, and they can change the direction. But I could have 100 people logged in from anywhere in the world, all pulling on this same glass puck. And then we have AI that's watching all of the magnets, and it's learning over time from how people use the magnets, the strength of their conviction. And so it's determining from the magnitude direction of these magnets, the strength of their conviction, and it's evaluating the full group in real time. And then it's the AI that's controlling the direction of this puck. And so what happens is a question appears, everybody in the group behaves, meaning they move their magnet, they start pulling to their direction. The AI watches all the behaviors, assesses their relative levels of conviction. The puck starts to move, but as soon as the puck starts to move, everybody changes they behave differently, right? And so people then adjust how they behave, and then AI gets a better sense of their relative levels of confidence and conviction. And so you could see this, you know, the puck could start moving in a direction, stop, move, and it will find the decision that is, in most cases, the best combination of the knowledge and wisdom and insight and conviction of the group, and it converges on an answer, and it works really, really well. And I'll give examples of how well it works. And I'll also give examples of the limitations, and because there is an interesting limitation, which is this method is really good for problems where they're constrained in advance, meaning, you know, okay, you need a group to decide among a set of five options or six options and converge, or you need a group to, you know, to predict the probability of something, and you can give them a spectrum of probabilities. Like, so a contained problem, it's not great for open-ended problems, but the next generation of technology gets to these open-ended problems in an interesting way. And so when you do use this method that is, it gives groups these constrained problems, and you allow them to form a swarm instead of just taking a vote, which would be the normal way you would do it. I've got six options, let's take a vote. It turns out a swarm outperforms a vote by a large margin in dozens and dozens of different academic studies. We did a study, for example, with Stanford Medical School. It was funded by NSF, where we used groups of doctors, and they were asked to diagnose patients. And these were actually relatively small groups, groups of five or six doctors. An X-ray would pop up on their screen, the same X-ray, the same patient. And then they would be asked to diagnose, for example, what's the probability that this patient has pneumonia? And they were asked to either do it as individuals, do it by taking a vote, or do it as a real-time swarm where they're all controlling this magnet. And it turned out that when they worked together as a swarm, they reduced their diagnostic errors by over 30% compared to doing it individually or taking a vote. We did a similar type of study with researchers at Oxford, looking at financial traders. And these were a little bit larger groups of like 15 traders, asking them to predict the price of gold, the price of oil, the S&P 500. Again, they did it as individuals. They did it as basically a wisdom of crowd. They would basically take a vote and aggregate. And then we did it as a real-time swarm where they would converge on. And they were 26% more accurate in predicting the change in, and this was weekly changes, and the study was went over 20 weeks. So it was weekly changes over 20 weeks, 26% more accurate in predicting the direction of these assets when they work together as a swarm. And so those are two examples. There's lots of other studies. Actually, on our website, unanimousai.com, we have copies of all these papers that always, frankly, amaze us, because our philosophy, like, humans are smart. And you connect them together with some power of AI, and like, we're really smart together, because we basically fill in the gaps in each other's knowledge, and it's really powerful. The one limitation that we've faced over the last 10 years of working in this space is when we bring groups together in this graphical way, we can allow groups to make really good decisions, but we have to be able to define the problem well in advance, like a forecast. Works really well for forecasting. Diagnosis, the question is really well formulated. But we don't necessarily capture, the why. Like, okay, they predicted the price of oil in a certain way. We know exactly what their forecast is. That's really helpful. We don't exactly know why. What were the sentiments behind that? And if we didn't know the options in advance, like if the group itself has to come up with the options, that method doesn't work. And so over the last year, a little more than a year, we've been focused on using this technology of Swarm AI and combining it with large language models so that we can allow groups to do this same process of pushing and pulling and negotiating conversationally instead of through graphical magnets. And so we call this conversational swarm intelligence. And it works. It makes groups smarter. And it, again, is still very much inspired by the biology. And so it's worth just mentioning back the school of fish that I mentioned at the beginning. So the school of fish I mentioned, they all basically have this little conversation. So a school of fish can have 1,000 individuals. They all basically are having a conversation. But the way it works is that each little group of neighbors can detect the vibrations of the fish around them. And you have all these different overlapping groups. And so the information can propagate across the whole school. And so you could have this large group of 1,000 fish essentially having this simple conversation and making decisions in real time. And so for humans, our goal is, well, if we want to take advantage of the power of collective intelligence conversationally, we'd love to be able to have 1,000 people have a conversation, or even just 100 people have a conversation. It turns out that a lot of people have researched conversations over the last century. The most productive size of a conversation is about 4 to 7 people. And once you get above that, it really just breaks down. And it breaks down for a pretty obvious reason, which is as you increase the size of a group, the amount of airtime per person in the conversation goes down. And the amount of wait time for having to react to somebody else goes up. And so 4 to 7 people works pretty well. When you get to about 10 to 12 people, it stops really being a conversation. It's more a series of monologues. And when you get to about 20 people, it's just chaos. It's not even a like conversation. So if you wanted to have a Zoom call with 20 people, like, that's not a conversation. So the big issue for us is, well, how do you reconcile the fact that we know groups get smarter the bigger the group gets? We know groups deliberate great through conversation, but we can't allow conversations of big groups. And so the first thing is, well, let's do what fish did and have just these overlapping groups. And so we could break a group of 100 people into 20 groups of 5 people, have all these groups overlap, and let the conversation spread like it does in a fish school. Well, turns out that we humans did not evolve to do that the way fish did. And I say that because if you're in a conversation and you overhear another conversation next to you, you get really confused. Like, there's actually a name for it. It's called the cocktail party problem. And so we actually evolved the opposite way. We evolved so that if you're at a cocktail party and you're talking to 4 or 5 other people, your brain tunes out the group next to you, because we can't pay attention to two conversations at once. And so that's where large language models came in for building a conversational swarm intelligence. What we did is we said, okay, let's take a group of 100 people or 1,000 people. Let's say it's 1,000 people. We can break them up into 200 groups of 5. Each of those groups of 5 can have a really coherent deliberation. And let's put an artificial agent into each of those 200 groups. And that artificial agent is there to observe the little conversation happening among the 5 people. and then pass insights to the artificial agents in other rooms, which can then express those insights in those other rooms. So it's the artificial agents that are passing information around, allowing all the groups to overlap in a way that we humans couldn't do it. And so we said, like, in paper, that looks like that should work. And it turns out it does work. And so we've never done 1,000 people. We've done 400 people in a single conversation, and we're going larger and larger. And groups can hold a single conversation. They can have the benefit of local deliberation in a small group. And they also have the benefit of global collective intelligence of a large group. And they can converge together on insights and decisions and ideas that are really, really smart, that outperform, you know, what the group would have done, certainly if you put the group together in just one big group, or even, you know, if you just had a bunch of small groups. So that's the latest generation of the technology. And we've been doing a bunch of research studies over the last year or so that have, again, been really interesting of how groups communicate this way. And it really makes this idea of building a large scale collective superintelligence that's, you know, 1,000 people or 10,000 people, or, I mean, the technology is scalable. You could essentially have 1,000,000 people holding a single real-time conversation, brainstorming, deliberating, and converging on solutions together. And that's the direction that we see it moving.
Wow, really interesting. And I can think of so many questions, you know, as you talk about it. I mean, certainly the good, you know, beneficial uses, you know, the example you gave of the doctors improving the accuracy of the diagnosis, for sure. Are there any concerns about how this could be misused? You know, I'm thinking, like, are we going to get collective superintelligence of tyrants, or collective military superintelligences? You know, and I wanted to relate that question as well to the idea of how you can ensure that humans maintain control of this AI. Because, I mean, there's significant concerns. You mentioned large language models, significant concerns, of course, about OpenAI's technology and the way that's developing. So maybe if you could just talk about that aspect of it.
Yeah. So like any technology, we worry about, okay, this is a technology that could be abused in a different way than other AI technologies. And so, and by could be abused, I mean, there has to be a level of trust that you know that the technology is doing what it says it's doing. Because the key thing is that the thing that distinguishes this from, say, a traditional use of a large language model is that the AI in the system, the large language model, it's not being used to give its own opinion. It's not being used to find information from the world. It's being used to observe humans and pass human sentiments. And so the system is designed so that it's humans making the decisions, humans doing the deliberation, humans coming up with the ideas, and the AI is there as a way, a message passing mediator. And the large language model still has to, these, you know, large language models are amazing technologies because they have to understand what the people are saying, and they can, which is the amazing thing, but they're not adding their own perspective. And so in theory, as long as you can trust that the AI system is doing that, it is entirely humans in the loop, humans making the decisions, and the information being passed in a fair way. And we work really hard to make the information get passed in a fair way that is also an efficient way. Meaning, if a particular subgroup is talking about an issue and they have certain insights, and there's another subgroup that has very similar insights, not that efficient to pass that information between those two because they're seeing the same thing. And so the way the system works is it's looking for, when a group has an insight, it's looking for what other groups have not considered that insight. Let's pass to those other groups. And so it's really, its mission is really to make sure that the group is, that every group is getting maximally exposed to the insights from other groups. And so it's really about information transfer and not making a value judgment about this is the right answer, this is the wrong answer. And I'll give you an example of a study we just ran that kind of shows that this works in kind of an amazing way. We wanted to quantify how much smarter are these groups getting, and do it in a way that's not just about, hey, can you forecast this, or hey, can you diagnose that, And so we said, well, let's give these groups an IQ test, a standard IQ test. And we said, the groups were just 35 people. We said, let's give groups of people IQ tests by themselves and see what that does. And let's give groups of people IQ tests and aggregate the data the way Wisdom of Crowd method, which would be, let's take the most popular answers and see what that does. And then let's have groups take this IQ test together in real time, conversationally, as this conversational swarm intelligence. And it's we're using a software platform we created to do this called ThinkScape, which is still a beta platform. And it turns out really interesting. So the individuals give 35 people an IQ test. The average individual will score 100. That's how IQ tests are designed, that the average person should score 100 on IQ tests. And so that did what it expected. The average person gets the scores 100, is the 50th percentile. If you take the most popular answers from that survey and aggregate similar to what Sir Francis Galton did 100 years ago, you get an amplification. You get up to an IQ of 112, and you get up to like the 80th percentile. So collective intelligence works. The wisdom of crowd works, but it can't solve the hardest problems, because when it's really a small minority of people who can see the logic, it's not going to propagate, or it's not going to sway a poll like that. And then we had the groups work as a conversational swarm intelligence, and they boosted their IQ when they groups of 35 up to 128, which is a 97th percentile of IQ. And so we took basically a group that averages 100 IQ, and they performed at a 128 into the 97th percentile. And one of the things that's so interesting is that to solve the hard problems in this group of 35 people, and it was 35 people broken up into like seven groups of five, and each of those seven groups of five never interact directly with any of the other people. They're just interacting with the four other people. The people who can see the logic of the hardest questions, there might just be a few of them scattered throughout this group of 35. And yet those insights can propagate across the full population. And yet those insights also, you know, the interesting thing is that there are also people who have completely bad insights, right? Like, so those correct insights are rare, but there's also lots of rare, totally wrong insights. And so what's interesting is that in this small group of five, the person who has a rare insight that's right, they first have to convince those other four people, right? Like that idea needs to gain some momentum inside this little group. And if those other four people are like, oh, like that makes sense. Like now the AI that's watching that conversation can say, oh, like this is gaining momentum. I can pass this insight on to other groups. And so that insight can propagate around, and that full group of 35 can get to this, solve these hard IQ questions. And again, it's very much the idea of what a fish school does, but it uses the large language model and the AI to account for the fact that we just didn't evolve to be able to do what fish do.
Yeah, interesting. And so if I'm connected to one of these systems with a group of, I don't know, 30 people or whatever, is this actually a visual connection at the same time? Like, am I seeing their body right. language as well as their words?
So right now it's not. So the technology is definitely built to be scalable to voice chat and to video chat. But right now it's text chat. And it's text chat mostly because whether you're doing video chat or voice chat, you're always going to convert back to text before you're going into a large language model. It's also text chat because with text chat, people can be anonymous, and they actually prefer that in a lot of ways, especially, you know, if you're bringing together a group of people to if they're anonymous, they're less afraid to be wrong, right? Like if it's a group of doctors or a group of financial analysts or a group of just consumers. And it's really also pretty powerful because it allows people some more time to think and to read other people. And it, in some sense, it's even more efficient. They can speak into the text chat. So they don't have to type if they don't want to. They can give their answer. It'll appear in the, like it would for other text systems. And then you can just click send and it goes into the text chat. But we do definitely, you know, we've built the technology so that it would be relatively straightforward to go straight to voice chat and ultimately video chat, because people will want that in certain contexts. But the yeah it, it mm. right now it is it's text chat, and again mm-hmm. We've used it for a lot of really interesting things via text chat, looking, you know, asking, you know, groups of political respondents, you know, questions about, you know, what is their perception of, like who would be a candidate that would get the most support across a large pool of candidates. And then you get, you know, people start arguing, and that's really the most interesting, like in these little groups, people start arguing, but the arguing is like, that's the tug of war, right? Like in the bee swarm or the fish school, it's the tug of war that reveals the different levels of conviction. And so that's what makes it so different than just taking a survey. If you take a survey, you'll get a lot of input, but you really won't know the strength of the conviction of all the people. And you could even ask people to tell you, well, how strongly do you feel on a scale of 1 to 5? But like my 5 might be the same as somebody else's 3. And so, but when you break a group up like this and you ask them for their input and they're arguing with each other and they're convincing each other, the AI system is watching that. It can really evaluate, you know, how much confidence does somebody have in a prediction, or how much conviction do they have in a point of view? And does the whole group, that small group, reach a certain level of conviction? And then it uses that in how it's passing information around. And it can also see, like, okay, this idea gained momentum in this little group and it gets passed to this other group. Does it then gain conviction in that other group, or does it just die out? Like, is it maybe these people, you know, they just fooled themselves into some idea. And when it hit a different group, it didn't propagate. And so it's, in some sense, it's like a market economy. Like the ideas that can gain support and propagate through the full network, they win. And the ideas that, that might, you know, might gain some momentum in a local group that can't make it outside the group, it's probably because that group just wasn't considering some factor. And we test on sports predictions all the time. And the reason we do sports predictions is that you get an answer the next day, like, was the group right or wrong? And, you know, one group might be really confident about a certain team winning, and another group might actually know, well, no, there's an injury on that team that's like a big problem. And so that sentiment of like, oh, this team is going to win could hit that other team, and the other team will say like, oh, no, there's this injury. And then that reason will then propagate. And so it allows, it just allows groups to surface ideas and surface counter ideas, and the group converge on answers.
Interesting. And actually, I have two questions because they're related questions, I guess, because you mentioned the political arena, which of course is subject to all sorts of manipulation these days. What areas do you see, what arenas do you see this application being used mainly in, like politics or medicine or industry? You know, and so that's the first question, I guess. And then the second question is, as I understand the system, it's kind of like a reporting system, I guess, where it's passing along the weightings that we give to probabilities and then allowing us to adjust those weightings over time. And I guess, what controls are there to ensure that the system itself isn't incorrectly judging those weightings? You know, if it's reporting, you know, hey, this group has this, you know, really interesting idea, and it's this has emerged as the idea from this group. How do we know that its reporting is accurate on that? And, you know, with respect to whatever arena it's being used in.
Yeah. So first thing is, yeah, it has to function correctly. And if it has an error in it, it could lead to the groups not converging on good answers. And so part of it is making sure that the methods and the analysis methods work. And part of it is also to make sure it's transparent so that anybody can go back and look at the data and see, like, did that really work? And so one of the pieces that we've built is, we call it an insight engine, where, so first of all, let's say I wanted to have a group of people, 100 people, hold a conversation about, and to give an example use case, like market research is one use case where there's lots of interest in it. And that, you know, spans political polling or consumer insights. And so market researchers, you know, they make their whole living trying to understand what a group of people think. So that's why it's a good example. And so we could have 100 people come in, and they're broken up into 20 groups, and they're going to be asking about their, we actually just did this for Super Bowl ads a couple weeks ago. We said, like, assess, you know, these relative Super Bowl ads and, you know, what you feel about them. And so the groups come in. And so we have this portal where a market researcher can watch in real time what's happening in the conversation. And, you know, watching 20 groups, 20 independent groups hold conversations, that would be like trying to watch 20 overlapping focus groups in real time. Like going in and watching the actual conversations really hard. So we have these graphical tools that's showing the sentiment, like all the ideas that are emerging and the sentiments, and so you can watch in real time and see the sentiments and just watch it evolve. And just watching the whole thing evolve, you can see, you know, like, is this seem right? But then when the session's over, we have this insight engine where you could then go back and replay the entire conversation. And you could say, okay, you know, this idea about this particular ad emerged here. How did the AI assess that sentiment? You could just click on the dial and dialogue it and see the AI's assessment. And then you can jump in and say, well, let's watch that one little room where that idea emerged. And we say, oh, like that idea then got passed to this other room. Let's go look at where that happened. And so you can go back and you can check what happened and validate. And, you know, we use that to make sure that when it's getting designed, it's designed right. But we make it available to, you know, to somebody who's just doing research, like consumer research, so that they can, like, if something looks like that, like they're surprised by that, let's go back and just see, like, would a human have assessed that the same way? And if not, like, you know, so all the data is accessible. You asked, the other question you asked was about, you know, other uses, and like market research is a really interesting one. Another obvious one is enterprise collaboration, just team, like business teams that want to hold a conversation and reach a decision, whether it's to talk about priorities or to make market forecasts. And again, like they could just have a meeting if it's a group of, you know, 5 to 10 people, but if they have 50 people, or 100 people, or a whole company of, you know, 1,000 people, and they want to tap the intelligence of that whole group, they can't do that. But this ThinkScape software would allow them to bring 100 people in and discuss the future of their company. And that's an interesting application as well. But the most interesting is where it gets to the political realm, not so much political polling, but what's usually referred to as civic engagement. There's so much interest from politicians to want to understand the sentiments of the public. And right now, their only option is really to do polling. And polling is really problematic. Polling, by its very nature, is polarizing. That's what a poll is. And so if I give people a poll, that doesn't tell me what they agree on. It tells me what they disagree on. And then I publish the poll, and now I just reinforced their disagreement. And so we're creating a polarized society by very nature that our tool is polls. Now, if instead I wanted to understand the public and I brought a 1,000 constituents into a swarm using a ThinkScape and they can talk about, you know, what they think are the biggest dangers of AI and what the policymakers should do, the group of 1,000 people who have very different political perspectives, they will converge on the solutions that they can best agree upon, rather than just revealing and reinforcing their differences. And so to me, that's like these larger civic questions and political questions where we really want to find positive solutions that people can agree upon, I think is the best application and the one that we, you know, we're pushing the most for, because it has the potential to allow us to either collectively solve difficult social problems that we can't agree upon, or collectively solve different difficult scientific problems. Like if you could bring together a group of 1,000 scientists who probably have their own political divide on very subtle issues that again, like what happens when you can, instead of forcing a group of scientists to break up into factions, you can have this group of scientists form a collective superintelligence that can find the ideas that they can collectively get the most confidence in, the most conviction in, and will that be a better solution? And I think ultimately it will be.
Interesting. It's And certainly that's encouraging to hear, I guess, in today's polarized world, that there's something out there that could actually break down that and find the common elements instead of the differences. So yeah, really interesting to hear. And you know, I think combined with the controls that you spoke about, the ability to assess what the system has done so that it's not a black box, that it's open and transparent, I think is would certainly be the key. I wanted to just talk in the minutes that we have remaining about kind of maybe two connected things. So I understand you are the chief scientist for the Responsible Metaverse Alliance, and that you also have a new book, I think, that's being published this month, Our Next Reality. And I wonder if you could maybe just talk about both of those and the connections between those. What led you to write the book?
Yeah, so the book is called Our Next Reality, and I wrote it with the co-author Alvin Graylin about really the future of computing. And it's the future of computing from the perspective that over the last 100 years, technology has kind of changed our world. And over the next 10 years, it's really going to change our reality. And change our reality because of really two things: immersive media and artificial intelligence. And they're deeply connected. And so immersive media, some people can call it the metaverse. Apple now calls it spatial computing. For decades, it's been called virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality. But really, to me, this issue of immersive media is this idea that computing is really going to make this major change, where right now we have kind of our digital lives that are trapped on little screens in our hand or on our desk, and our physical lives. And 10 years from now, we could very easily be in a world where our digital lives and physical lives are combined. And you just look around the world and digital content exists in your world in the place it should be. That's just naturally integrated. And we don't even think about the real and the virtual. We just think about there's reality and it has physical stuff, but it also has photorealistic virtual content everywhere you go. And enabling that will be lightweight mixed reality eyewear. The highest quality of such eyewear just came out from Apple to start shipping in February, so a month ago. The device is remarkable in that if you put on a Vision Pro, you can see this mixed reality. Virtual content can look like it's just a part of your world. But the device is still big and it's still bulky and it still has battery issues. But all the major companies in the world are working towards this time when these devices are smaller and cheaper and have long battery life. And we're really not that far away from that happening. Google and Samsung have a partnership to make this happen. Meta just announced a partnership with LG to make this happen. Apple. And what's interesting about these partnerships is that it's really not the virtual reality community that's doing this. It's the mobile phone community that's doing this, right? Google, Samsung, Meta, LG, they're all looking and they're saying, you know, the thing that replaces the phone is eyewear, and this eyewear is going to put virtual content everywhere. And that's our next reality. Our next reality is that we don't hold our phone in our hand from the time we wake up to the time we go to sleep. We wear glasses all day and virtual content is there. And this next reality, for it to exist, for it to happen, it has to be powered by AI for a lot of different reasons. One of which is that if you want to add virtual content to the world at scale, an AI really is needed to do that. Two, if you want the virtual content to be customized for each individual so that they see the things that are relevant to them, AI is required. And three, these large language models that we think about, like the most recent advance that's so powerful is what's called multimodal large language models. And a multimodal large language model means that it doesn't just take in text, it can take in real-time video and real-time audio. And so Meta is already building multimodal AIs into their smart glasses that they call their Ray-Ban smart glasses, which has cameras and microphones, so that the AI doesn't just respond to what you say, but it responds to what you can see and hear as you go through your world. So we're getting to this reality where you're going to go through your life AI systems are going to visually change the way the world looks. They're going to see what you see. They're going to hear what you hear. And if you're walking down the street and you look in a store window and it sees you're looking at something, it's going to know, oh, like it should tell you something about that and maybe even show you something about that. And you won't even have to say anything. And so this is a world that we're heading towards that has really amazing possibilities. It will make the world literally magical, and also really significant dangers. Significant because think about the danger of you are now putting on a headset from some corporation, and that corporation can control what you see and what you hear and can track everything you do, and is doing that in real time with AI. Extremely dangerous. And so the book is written as a debate. Our next reality, Alvin kind of takes the positive side of the debate, and every chapter has a positive side of, well, here are the amazing things that you can do for education and medicine. And I take the negative side of the debate, saying, okay, but this could be abused in really dangerous ways, because now you have an AI that's whispering in your ear. And if it's whispering in your ear for your benefit, great. But if it's whispering in your ear as a form of influence on behalf of a corporation or a state actor, like, that's profoundly dangerous. And so the book really is about, okay, this is going to happen because all of the major corporations are pushing in this direction. It's also going to happen because the technology is available to make it happen. It can do amazing things, but unless we have guardrails, unless we have real regulation and policy, the potential for manipulation and influence and propaganda and disinformation, not just on your screen, but just in your world, is really extreme. And so we really raise the alarm on that front. And so, yeah, so that the book is called Our Next Reality. It's available now for pre-order on Amazon. The ebook and the audiobook come out next week, and then the hardcover ships a little bit later, but it's available for pre-order now.
Mm-hmm. And that debate format sounds really intriguing. It's because, I mean, I guess nobody has the answers, and yet there are both sides to the question. And so how do we come out to some sort of reconciliation, I guess, between the sides? I mean, you spoke about guardrails. What would you think is the best or most probable guardrail that we could implement?
Yeah. So to me, when you're talking about just the visual manipulation of your world, we have to understand that advertisements in this immersive world are not going to be just pop-up ads, and like they will just be product placements just placed into your world. And you might not even know that it's a product placement. You're just walking down the street and you see something and it draws your attention and you keep walking and you just thought it was authentic. That's very going to be doable, you know, in the next 10 years. It should be illegal, meaning it should, if something is placed into your environment, especially if it's put on behalf of a paying sponsor as influence, it should be visually distinct. Now, the same thing happens when we start interacting with artificial agents. One of the biggest changes that we see coming from large language models is not the things that policymakers are so worried about right now. They're worried about deep fakes. They're worried about, you know, creating misinformation at scale. What's really dangerous is that you can deploy conversational agents to engage people at scale and not just show them a piece of content, talk them into a perspective. And I know that sounds foreign, but we have to understand that over the next few years, websites and everything that you interact with are going to go from filling out forms on a website to a photorealistic avatar pops up and then you just hold a conversation. And so if you go to a car website, there's going to be a virtual salesperson that pops up on that website, and it's going to start asking you questions, and you're going to be answering, and you're going to be answering a lot more, giving a lot more detail than if you filled out a form online. And when you fill out a form online, you know you're giving information. If you're holding a conversation with a virtual agent that looks human, and they will look perfectly human, you're not thinking, oh, this is information going into a database that's going to get shared with a million other artificial agents that are going to talk to me else at other times. And so the thing that, you know, really policymakers need to focus on is that these conversational agents are going to start making information collection and influence interactive. And so now I'm going to talk to artificial agents. They can extract information from me more skillfully than a form, and they can influence me more skillfully. If an artificial agent wants to sell me something, it's going to be much more skilled than a human salesperson, because it's going to be trained on sales techniques. It's going to be trained on cognitive psychology techniques. It's going to be able to read my emotions off of my face. It's going to have access to a vast database of data about my personal interests and hobbies. And so I'm going to start talking to this virtual agent. It's going to know how to steer the conversation to mention some things that, you know, if I like a sports team, it'll mention that sports team. If it knows that I'm more susceptible to logic-based arguments, it will go that way. If it knows I'm more susceptible to emotion-based arguments, it'll go another way. It'll be customized just for me. And as the conversation evolves, if I raise objections, it will work to overcome my objections. Like, that's a form of influence that we've never seen before, that makes the type of influence we have on social media seem primitive. And policymakers are not ready for that, and they need to be ready for that. And they need to really realize that just producing today's influence at scale is not the big danger of AI. The big danger of AI is when you're interacting in real time. I call that the manipulation problem, because these AI systems could easily be designed to manipulate us. And if it's trying to manipulate us, you know, to get us to buy a car, that's one thing. If it's trying to manipulate us to get us to believe a piece of misinformation, like, that's really dangerous. And these systems will be skilled at doing it unless it's illegal. And there are really clear barriers, really clear protections, so that we know that these artificial agents cannot be designed to manipulate us on an individual basis, but do it at scale.
That's really interesting to imagine that world that's emerging that you described. I think it's, you know, and I think at the same time, you've provided an example of how that kind of future could be more human controlled, I guess, more human focused, human centered. So I think that's the, that's what I'm really taking away from this discussion. And, you know, unfortunately we are out of time, but I'd love to continue this discussion more, because there's so many questions and so many thoughts and ideas that I think you've raised that I think are worth exploring, and we'd like to see where this goes. So I wanted to thank you very much, Lewis, for your time. You presented a very different world, I think, than I had imagined when I went into this discussion.
Yeah, well, it'd be great to have another discussion about more of these issues. The book is coming out. It goes into a lot of these issues, but I think you're exactly right, which is the best solution is to keep humans in the loop. That's really the more that humans are central to this process, and we're not replacing humans in the decision-making process, and the better off that we are.
Yeah, I think that's the key for sure. So we look forward to our next reality, your new book coming out, and I look forward to our next discussion.
Yeah, me too. All right. Great chatting. Yeah,
thank you so much. Our thanks go to today's guest and to you for listening to the Quantum Feedback Loop. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out The Quantum Record at thequantumrecord.com. The Quantum Record is a monthly journal of philosophy, science, technology, and time, where you'll find the latest developments in our rapidly evolving technological world.